Hello, welcome to edition 376 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, and Tom Edwards.
On the show today, we'll be joined by Harry Shearer, the broadcaster, actor, satirist and journalist whose own podcast, Le Show, makes him one of the most well-known voices on the radio. Voicing a good chunk of the characters on one of the world's biggest TV shows, The Simpsons, also helps with that too, I imagine.
We'll also meet the band coming together from as far-flung locations as Germany, Mexico and Sweden. They're called Exploded View, to learn why their sound offers a fresh and worldly perspective.
And we'll be talking fashion with Judith Clark, co-creator of a forthcoming exhibition at London's Barbican venue named The Vulgar, Fashion Redefined. We'll be going overboard at the end of the show.
All that plus Monocle's Henry Rees-Sherwin will be tripping down the runway dressed as some kind of respectable journalist in the news look ahead, and we'll play some music, quite likely some Exploded View too, right here on the Monocle Weekly. Here we are, Tom. Do you feel a little bit of chill settling? Not over the always freezing studios of Monocle 24,
no,
but
there's
over
this kind
London.
Of, yeah, a slightly autumnal freshness after the sort of Indian summer that we enjoyed.
Yeah.
Birthday tidings to you, Mr. Bound.
I don't think there's anywhere I'd like to blow out my candles than in Studio One. Oh, can you turn down the aircon? I think my cake's got not just icing but ice on it.
Spending the day with me?
Yeah,
surely that's,
this is what I want.
Who could want more than that?
This is what I want. I want to be spending my birthday in here in Studio One with you, Tom, and with the viewing several. Listening several. This isn't a podcast. I mean, this
be
isn't
fair
a webcam,
though. I'll tell you what. If you were planning the fantasy Robert Bound birthday party, I'll tell you a guest that would very well be on the list.
Yeah? Who?
All-round legend of polymath Harry Shearer, and he's coming in.
He is coming in.
That's pretty special.
I mean, what I don't want is for a legend, one of my heroes, to sing happy birthday to me. That's the last thing I want.
Okay.
So
I just need to drop him a note. Hang on.
Here we go. Yeah, exactly.
He's on the way later. He's got one of those things.
Yeah, exactly. What do you call that?
I don't know. One of those blowy outy snake rolly blowy things.
No one really knows what they're called. A party popper.
No, those
party
are the pooper. Old things you pull the string and
the streamers come out. Called. Do we have any items on the agenda that we need to tick off? What we should say, we've literally got a brace of tickets left for the Culture Show tomorrow.
That's
we're
right.
We're doing a live
Monday
edition
night.
Of the Culture Show.
People
with
have got to get along.
Such as...
You're hosting. I hope you
I'm
know.
Hosting. I think I'm going to be there. I'm contractually obliged to be there. So that's me.
What's the big question? You're posing a big question and answering it with some extraordinary individuals.
So, yeah, we're asking, is London still the cultural capital of the world? A nice little poser. It's sort of not necessarily a post-Brexit thing, but there's all sorts of things that are all sorts of shifting sands in the very competitive world of sort of high-level culture, whether we're talking about museums, whether we're talking about art fairs, whether we're talking about nightlife and the people that sort of give and take from it. So we've got Victoria Siddle, who runs the Frieze Art Fairs. She's a big deal. We've got Sir Nicholas Kenyon, who's the boss of the Barbican here in
London. Knight of the Realm.
Exactly.
That's right.
And we've got Will Hodgkinson, who's our pal, who's the chief music writer for The Times, who's a groovy presence. And also Jordan Gross, who founded the Oval Space, which is a very cool place out east where you can dance, you can drink, you can look at paintings, you can do all sorts of things.
You can do most of those things
so
as well.
So it's a pretty cool thing. It'll be a good thing. There'll be wine, women and song promised,
and
I expect.
A couple, I think it's literally just a pair of tickets
a brace.
Left. Get amongst it.
A brace.
On the website.
Okay. Get there. And what else do we have? Do we have anything else? Are we flogging anything else?
Well, I'll tell you, a man who knows a thing or two about the cards to mark, the things to watch in the week ahead.
Yeah.
Monocle's Henry Rees Sheridan.
Oh, my goodness. Henry, oh, Henry. Blow the way you jump and rock. All right. Henry, oh, Henry. Blow the way Texas hop. But how am I doing now?
It's a party blower.
Okay.
Is that what it's called?
That's it, straightforward. You're nearly there. But I think you were trying to
somewhere else.
You were reaching too hard and far for something. You were trying to over-intellectualise it, I think. It's just a party blower. And you're talking about they're coiled and they have a kind of plastic mouthpiece.
Yeah. That's right.
And when you go through them,
and sort of papery thing extends.
They both emit a kind of kazoo-like
sound. Do they still exist?
And
yeah.
I imagine so.
I haven't
been informed of that.
I think they may have stopped existing in about 1985.
I was going to say, in my life, they sort of stopped existing about 1985.
Yeah.
Did you ever have one that you had sort of like a favourite one and you kind of kept it from a party, but then its blower ran out, but it would still do the unfurling thing?
What mine would always do, it would always, because I used to blow with some force, it would split the
extending protuberance.
The sleeve. would split around the mouthpiece and it would lose some of its force.
Okay.
So watch out for that, indeed. But there's a plug to get in. On the 28th of September, the new, I think it's Monocle Guide to Drinking and Dining. It's being launched and they're having an event to launch it at Midori House. Ruth Rogers is going to be
legend.
There.
A titan supremo of the London foods, well, the international food scene, let's call it.
Plus, Andrew Tuck, Tyler Brulé, Josh Fennett, Monocle's finest, arguably, not Monocle 24's. Obviously, we're covering that.
The
base.
Dream team, isn't it?
Drinks, laughter, all the stuff that Rob mentioned, but perhaps with less musicians and cultural people and art people. Food people instead.
That's more. That is a guaranteed lash up. Mine has a sort of slightly irritating intellectual veneer.
Yeah,
and unnecessary, you might say.
Yeah. Indeed,
and entirely superfluous. That sounds like fun. Now, Henry, details of that, like Culture with Robert Bound, all available at the website.
All
just
available
head to monocle.com. It's that easy
and far more accurate and reliable than my telling of them here.
Yeah, but
as well.
I think so people respond to that, don't they? This is the call
it's
and
the
response.
The human touch.
People respond to inaccuracy.
Yeah. No, the human touch.
On the 22nd of September, there's a general election taking place.
Is that happening here as well? Are we selling tickets to that?
It's not happening at Midori House.
Where is it? In Tanzania?
Nearly.
Somewhere like that.
The Isle of Man.
Whoa,
can anyone tell me what the legislature of the Isle of Man is called? It's got a good name.
Is it in Douglas?
Yeah,
I don't know.
It
probably
Douglas.
Is.
It would be in Douglas. Yeah. I don't know what it's called.
Have you ever been in Douglas?
No.
I don't know. He was pretty insistent that I didn't.
The House of Keys.
Oh, that's
very
nice.
Yeah, that's right.
15 constituencies, 2 of which elect 3 members, 5 of which elect 2, and 8 of which elect 1, if you want to know the breakdown.
How many is that in total?
I'm not sure if there's going to be any coverage of the election. Someone might have a swingometer somewhere. I don't know. But I'm sure you
Douglas
can find...
Douglas has probably got one somewhere, hasn't he, tucked away?
Probably, Douglas, yeah. Douglas's swingometer.
Yeah, why not?
Oh, he's on the turn.
On the 18th of September, the World Gurning Championship is taking place.
Oh, stop it, Henry.
Cumbria, the annual
in Ibiza.
World Gurning Championship takes place at Egremont Crab Fair. So if you're going to be there anyway,
so where is this?
Don't
in the
miss
world?
This. Egremont Crab Fair in Cumbria.
In Cumbria, okay.
In England.
Yeah.
The Gurning event is the main attraction at the traditional Crab Apple Fair, so it's not a marine.
Oh, no, I thought we were being a little shellfish.
Event, and involved participants making the most grotesque faces possible with their heads stuck through.
Stop it, Henry! You're repulsing me.
With their heads stuck through a horse's harness.
Really?
Now I don't know what a horse's harness is. Is that the thing that goes over their muzzle?
No, it's the thing that they would have on to pull a cart, isn't it?
I suppose.
Harness. Yeah, it's not something you'd have for horseback riding.
Like, you know, the big leather clad ones that would be around a shire horse's mighty neck.
A dray.
With their
Dr. Dre.
What part of it is their head stuck through?
I don't understand. Well, no, they wear the thing there and then they go in like that.
Yeah, okay. That's old school, isn't it?
That doesn't work on radio.
A gurning competition is right up there with a kind of like knobbly knees competition or something. It's kind of very end of the pier, kind of seaside kind of thing. I like it.
Do you know how old it is?
150 years old.
Mate, guess again. The crowd
23 years old.
Dates back to 1267.
I thought you were talking about the Gurning Championships here. Okay.
1267.
Presumably, the Gurning Championships has been a component of the crab fair since its inception.
So.
Do you not think?
Is Gurning what happens if you eat a crab apple?
Yeah, I think this to do with sourness. Because the crab apple, really, they're
very tart.
They're to be stewed, aren't they? They're a cooking apple.
They are very, very tart, aren't they?
Yeah. Mm.
And finally, US Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton, you might have heard of her.
I thought I'd had enough of this.
Is appearing on Jimmy Fallon's Tonight Show on the 19th of September. Now, I want to know your thoughts on the category of broadcast event that Jimmy Fallon's show, which I'm sure you're both vaguely familiar with from YouTube clips, falls into. I have never been able to get on board with the late night kind of entertainment
talk show,
newsy entertainment, American talk show.
It occupies a very particular place in US culture. We don't really have an equivalent. People have tried to do it and it doesn't really work because it is a quasi sometimes political satirical piece. It's sort of newsy, but it's unashamedly entertainment.
This is good, isn't it? This is all seamless. It's become accidentally quite good and seamless.
And you never would have thought that about the news ahead.
Of our best intentions.
Henry, is that the end of your news look ahead?
That's all I've got to say. I'd be happy to discuss anything that you want to talk about further. You probably want me to get out so you can get on with the rest of the show.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. If not the favourite of your regular podcast listens, then we'd hope one of your very select chosen few. Within that handful, you'd also do very well to enjoy the broadcasting talents of Harry Shearer, whose own irreverent weekly look at the worlds of politics, comedy and music, Le Show, is one of the most popular podcasts out there. The screen, TV and radio legend will be presenting a special live edition of Le Show next weekend as part of the London Podcast Festival, so we advise listeners to go and check it out.
Shearer's presence throughout the entertainment world is a multifaceted thing. A former Saturday Night Live cast member, he's also the voice of many of your favourite characters from The Simpsons. And Shearer's put in untouchable performances in mockumentaries such as This Is Spinal Tap, companion piece A Mighty Wind and others. While making an impact in documentary making too, he directed The Big Uneasy, which recorded the effects of Hurricane Katrina on his home city of New Orleans. And he's here to talk about just some of that today. Harry, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you. And I have to edit your intro just a little bit. The film, The Big Uneasy, was to counter the widespread media understanding of what happened in New Orleans. It was not about the effects of Hurricane Katrina. It was why the city flooded in the first place, which had nothing to do with the hurricane. So just that little addendum. Thank you. No. Nice to be here.
That's good. We've got to get things right. You've got to keep us on our toes.
Yeah, that's what I made the movie to
I guess that
to,
was the point. Why did it happen? Yes. What happened afterwards?
Journalism used to teach people that you need to answer the five W's. And media coverage in the case of the flood of New Orleans answered four of the five and left the fifth one hanging.
We go through those five?
Who, what, where,
you were
when?
Newsweek, weren't you? You've been a journalist. You've brought one hat in.
I
taken it
one,
off
yeah.
like a gentleman.
Yes.
But there are a number of hats you've worn, one of which was being a journalist. And
yes.
You covered lots of things from riots, from tough stuff.
Yeah.
So this New Orleans film didn't come from out of nowhere.
That's correct.
For you at
That's
all.
Correct.
And obviously it's your home city.
I had the toolkit.
Yeah.
But the five W's is who, what, where, when, and why. And they left out the fifth W, most of the media coverage, which was a big one.
The toughest of the W's.
Perhaps.
Well, and Harry,
the W's sound like some sort of weird
band. Although I will say, very early on in the coverage of the flood, second day, I was watching CNN, and a guy in the Central Business District with ankle-deep water around his feet, around his ankles, actually, standing there with a microphone said, "I'm here in the French Quarter." So he didn't even get the wear right.
Right.
Well, and I wondered, I mean, it's interesting to queue up. Obviously, a lot of the American media is under a great deal of scrutiny at the moment. Well, the global media covering the presidential race. If people listen to the show, they'll probably know some of your thoughts and some of your your views and heard some of the skits and stuff you do. But what do you make of where the media's at in terms of how it's covering this presidential race? Because it feels different even than others. We're used to this, you know, incredible intensity of the candidates and so on. But this seems different, do you think?
Well, first of all, Britain's just fairly recently been through a general election as well as a referendum. Australia, where I was earlier this summer, just went through a general election. And I heard people down there, as here, complaining about this has been going on forever. This has been going on for 5 weeks. American elections go on for 18, 19, 20 months. You know, it's this endurance spectacle. And it's fueled, among other things, by the fact that the news organizations, particularly the television news organizations, have discovered that political coverage, especially people screaming at each other, is like ratings crack for them. Politics has become a profit center for broadcasters. It used to be a public service. That being said, you know, the media have been hollowed out in America to a great extent. You see the anchor at the shiny desk or the front page with the august, you know, masthead, and it still looks the same, but you go behind the front and there are three gerbils on a wheel.
Yeah. The Potemkin village.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's Potemkin media.
Yeah, it's strange stuff.
And strangely enough, trust in American media, the survey just came out yesterday, has plunged to an all-time high. Gallup noted it only 32% of American people trust the media now, down 8% in a year.
That's some going
in a democracy. So it's a very big problem. The presidential campaign is just the tip of the iceberg.
And what do you think about you almost have a responsibility now as a satirist. Rather than being on the outside looking in, it's almost as if yourself, maybe the Colbert Report, Jon Stewart, these sorts of people that have always had incisive, intelligent voices bent towards comedy, but also all about telling the truth, revealing the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that actually you've got more than just making people laugh? You actually have a responsibility that is almost you know, it's what a news agency should be doing.
Yeah,
well.
I mean, that occurred to me really during the run-up to the Iraq War, when, thanks to the internet, I was exposed to news, as I call it, from outside the bubble, and realized that I was aware of things Americans were not being told by our media, and thought, I have a microphone, I can connect the two.
Yeah.
Also, as a satirist, you can't make fun of things people don't know about.
Yeah, right. You have to tell people about them first. And
yeah.
Then, yeah.
Right. Yeah.
It's tough. It is strange. And there is that is a strange disconnect when the people that are making you laugh, you're kind of having to Google what they're making jokes about.
Yeah.
That's a...
Well, I mean, you want people to get what you're talking about. And the media, when I was talking about ratings crack before, they realized during the first Gulf War, CNN realized, that they had this huge spike because they had a big story. And then immediately after the Gulf War, the ratings plummeted. Pardon me. I didn't mean to hit your furniture.
It's good. It's a good sound effect to go plummeted.
Plummeted. Plummeted. For real. For real. Totally.
Okay.
So they thought, how can we make the non-hot news days feel like the hot news days? And they thought, ultimately, they came up with focus on one story. Whether it's big news or not, focus on it as if it were a big story and get people tense about it, and you know, and that will drive ratings. So you had this spectacle about a year and a half ago. CNN covered a cruise ship where people were trapped for 3 days and you know, pooping in their faces or something like that. And that was the big story. That was
that's what the rolling ticker was made for.
And that's what all you saw on CNN for 3 days.
Harry, where does radio fit into this? Because obviously the show, a lot of people may be coming fresh to the program as a podcast, but it's a radio staple. Did you have a love of radio? Is that still, as a means of... You know, speaking to people, it has an intimacy. Is it something
well, my
about
radio,
the way of communication?
My radio was falling apart, and so I needed to staple it back. No, sorry. I came up in radio, and so I understood it kind of instinctively how to do it. And it's in terms of energy, very efficient. In terms of you can put in a minimum amount of energy, get a maximum amount of impact inside the listener's brain, as opposed to the energy you'd have to devote to it in television or film. So it fits into the rest of my life, where the other things would be full-time jobs. And it sneaks into people's lives in a different way. You know, thanks to podcasting, I could widen its reach so that it didn't have to be there at a particular time, although I love the linearity of radio. I love being able to talk to a sizable audience at a certain given moment in time and know that we're all at that moment of time together. There's something special about that podcasts lack, but podcasts, you know, are with us, and they allow you to hear things on your own schedule. So I think I love both things for their particular virtues. But the medium itself, yeah, I've always loved it. My favorite artists, a lot of my favorite artists have been people who excelled at radio. Whether it was the Goons in this country or a comedy team in America, Bob and Ray, who really spent most of their career on radio, or Stan Freberg, the American satirical musical genius who started in radio. It's a great place to... And also, because if you're doing it on the way I do it, there's so little at stake. it's much easier to be left alone.
So you told us once that it's easy and you can just turn up in whatever you're wearing, and secondly there's not much at stake. Harry Shearer, stop hiding your light under a bushel. This thing is massive.
No, I'm just saying that, you know, in terms of television, there are people who read your scripts beforehand and you have meetings afterwards, and you know, all this time is wasted on not doing the thing.
Yeah.
And in radio, I've never had a meeting. I've never had anybody see what I do before I do it. So it's very much between me and the audience. We're the only participants in the transaction. I like it.
And how much of that is written? I mean, do you write down...
What I just said?
Follow up that piece of paper and put it back in your pocket. I want this to be...
Yeah. No, the radio show, I bring stuff with me to make reference to about the news of the day. Usually my comedy sketches are written and pre-recorded. Sometimes for certain characters, I can't write their dialogue because they talk so goofy, so I have to improvise it. There have been two or three characters like that I just went, I
It'll happen.
It'll happen. I can never get this on the page. So it just depends on what effect I'm trying to achieve. Similarly, I mean, when we set out to make Spinal Tap, we didn't set out to make an improvised movie. We just had an idea of the movie we wanted to make, which was a documentary covering a tour, and realized as we were about the fourth day of writing the script, no one was going to understand that script as a studio looking to either approve it or not approve it. And B, to make the movie, it wouldn't feel right to be scripted. I mean, I was astonished when I learned that The Office, Ricky's version, was scripted.
Because it felt improvised. So much that feel.
Yeah.
All of that comedy owes so much to Spinal Tap as well. That thing that is it real or isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, and is it scripted or isn't it? Secondarily,
and can Liam Gallagher tell the difference?
what makes an improv setup work then? Because obviously you've done lots of different things. You know, SNL, there was a lot of improv.
No.
This is what I wanted to ask you, because I know that you felt sometimes that was quite a restrictive atmosphere, but other luminaries have said, oh, it was great, you know, it was all improv. And I think people think, well, is one improv team not the same as another? Well, what makes it work for you?
First, let me just fact check. They're bullshitting, because
I'm not doing well with my facts today.
No, it's all right. That's all right. That's not you. That's people have told you that, or you've seen people say that. Marty Short was once talking to Dave Wilson, who was the director of the show for a number of years, most of the legendary years. And Marty said, Davey, I may improvise a thing when I'm in this scene. And Dave Wilson said to him, you can say it, I'm not going to see it, because he directed to the script. So
how did that reputation? I mean, it wasn't such a big thing in this country. Yeah. Maybe it was on the other side of the pond. But I mean,
count your blessings.
It was a big thing. But why did it gain that reputation?
Oh, people thought
it was a good narrative to tell.
Yeah, and people thought because it was ensemble comedy, it had to be improv and blah blah blah. But no, it was a very scripted show. Dave had been recruited because he was the only person at that time who knew how to do live television because of his experience shooting the Miss America pageants. That is true.
The two things are so similar.
Yeah,
right?
And those are some lines you want to be reciting.
I did all that
world peace stuff. Yeah. I wrote that. Oh, really? You're the guy. To go back to Spinal Tap then, Harry, were the characters so strong that they just had the life of themselves and you could make it up within the frames of those characters then, if it was a largely unscripted mm-hmm. film? Is that how it works? You know, when you've got Derek Smalls just right, you know what football jersey he's going to wear. We wanted to make reference to the Shrewsbury Town top,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes. Well, that was because...
But is that because the characters are so strong, they can do what they want almost?
Hopefully. I mean, the first thing we did was write the history of the band.
Yeah.
And so we all knew each other's history. And so we knew what we would have, as characters, known about each other and ourselves. So that was the basis of the project. And then when I came here before we made the film, I just thought, well, I think Elton John had just bought a Premier League team.
Yeah, right. Watford.
And I thought, well, Derek would aspire to that, but he wouldn't. He wouldn't quite be able to afford Premier League. So maybe Shrewsbury would be what he'd target, you know.
We did want to know that, didn't we?
I needed to know. I've always wondered.
Tick, tick, box.
Yeah,
tick,
I've got it all here. And there's a question, an addendum to that one.
Okay.
Is, you know, when you mastermind something like that, and then you go and work, and obviously, you know, you're such famous work for The Simpsons. What happens when you do your own show, you write your own stuff, and then you're reading someone, as a comedian, as a writer, as a satirist, then you're doing someone else's script? What is that transition like? Does that get a bit itchy around the neck? I wonder what that's like when you...
It's a very good question, and I don't say that because I'm thinking of the answer, which is what most people do when they say it's a very good question. No, you've cut to the core of something. I used to watch Fred Willard, mm-hmm. for example, or as you call him here, Willard, when he was working on a wonderful show called, which I don't think you all here have ever seen or heard of, called Fernwood Tonight, which was probably the first piss take of
with a two... With a number two in the middle, was it?
Two night.
Yeah,
yes.
Right. Yeah.
It was the first piss take of a late night chat show.
Yeah.
And Martin Mull was the host, and Fred Willard was the announcer sidekick. And I was a writer on the show, but I thought a lot of the stuff that was going by was sort of, and I would watch Fred, and we were doing two shows a day, very fast paced, and I would watch Fred kind of look at the stuff. You know, pacing in the garage beneath the studio to have a moment to just sort of memorize or whatever. And then I'd see him do this amazing transformation back in the studio, somehow magically make the unfunny funny. And I thought, that's an actor, not a writer hyphen actor.
Right.
Because to me, it's always going through that, boy, this stinks. Jesus, somebody should...
Because you want to do it to the letter all the time, or what is that?
Well, you don't have the freedom to change it, so you're stuck at that point. And he just goes to the place of, I got to make this funny.
Yeah.
And, I was in awe of that.
It's interesting you've used that expression freedom, I think, a couple of times. As a performer with all these different hats on, as Rob's mentioned, when do you have the moments that you feel most kind of creatively uplifted, when you just feel like you've left nothing there? Is it performing as a musician? Is it if you write something that you just know has nailed it, whether it's a satirical piece? Or is it necessarily a combination of all of these different things that contributes to the overall?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I just did a play here for a couple of years, not in this room, but in London and environs, and a serious play with Maureen Lipman, national treasure Maureen Lipman. She must be addressed that way.
Yeah. It's in her contract. Right?
In lieu of Lady or Dame, it's National Treasure, Maureen Lipman. Yeah. And that was as profoundly fulfilling as anything I've ever done. But normally, my answer to that would be something musical, playing, you know, because a few years back, I was looking back about this time of year, late August, early September, and what I'd done that year up to then. I'd done a live gig the night before Obama was sworn in we'd put a band together and did the songs from my record, which were all songs about the people in the Bush administration, called Songs of the Bushmen. And then we did a new Spinal Tap album, and then Christopher and Michael and I did a tour as ourselves called the Unwigged and Unplugged. And then Tap did Glastonbury and Wembley Arena.
Did you close Live Aid? Did you not?
Live Earth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No biggie.
Yeah, no biggie there. and so, you know, looking back on that year, I thought, well, I've never had more fun in my life than this run of stuff, you know? The whole, there's a horrible American word that's overused tremendously now, the journey. Yeah. The whole Spinal Tap journey has been amazing, you know, in every way, because movie almost never got made a million times. There was a million times when we heard the guillotine blade going down right behind us, you know, and we could have been caught. So the idea that it ever has had this a life, let alone this life, let alone this extended life and this huge kind of life, you know, in certain moments at least like that, is astonishing.
Can I ask about that? Because I did want to ask you about the accent specifically in Tap, because they're so perfectly judged within this world of, like, is it weird transatlantic East End home counties? Mm-hmm. And you would have thought only someone who'd had immersed in that, but maybe was from there, could do it. Is that a research job? How did you guys get there and get there seemingly so quickly for the original piece?
Well, Chris had a little advantage. His dad was English. So he grew up around English people and heard a lot of English people of different accents speak. I was a fan of British comedy from youth and heard a lot of accents, starting from the Goons and going through Pete and Dud and all that. And I think what really helped all of us, and I don't know, Michael also was exposed to the Goons and Pete and Dud at an early age. I think having a musical ear helps you nail that other stuff, you know.
It's like mimicry, right? It's the same
thing. It is mimicry, but it's mimicry of, you know, you find, I've watched some dialect coaches work in close proximity to me, and and I, you know, they focus.
It sounds like they were sitting on your knee or something.
No, in my vicinity.
Okay.
And they focus on pronunciation. And I think if you have a musical ear, you focus on the melody of the accent more. Mm. And every different way of talking has a different melody. And you can get by with getting the pronunciations a little bit off if you've got the melody right, because real people do. Yeah. Real people never pronounce, you know, every word in their dialect exactly right. They're sloppy and, you know, they hear TV and things get mushed up. But the melody is what you sort of born with or born very quickly hearing and absorbing, and the melody carries that. And I think that was a big gift that all three of us shared, you know, that we were able to do that.
We've got to bring it to a close. Harry Shearer, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
It's lovely to meet you.
You too.
We should point people in the direction of Le Show live at King's Place in King's Cross.
It's a week from today.
It's a week from today.
The 25th at 2 p.m. And there will be live music as part of the show, which is sort of special.
Yeah.
I've only done this once before ever, which is at South by Southwest. So it'll be shocking and scary for me as well.
London is highly honored, right?
Yeah. We are all honored.
We're all honored. I'm Harry Shearer. Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
Time for music now. In a moment, we'll be hearing from a band making music rooted in Berlin and finding listeners via Mexico, Sweden, and further afield. So let's hear a tune. This is Exploded View with Orlando. You were just listening to Exploded View. The band came together when British songwriter and former journalist Annika Henderson, known simply as Annika, left her adopted home of Berlin for Mexico, where she teamed up with Swedish producer Martin Tulin and Mexican musicians Hugo Quezada and Hector Melgarejo.
The resulting record is their self-titled debut, out now on the Sacred Bones label. It's a smart collection of off-kilter pop songs washed over with a hazy post-punk spirit. A little earlier, our producer, Monocle's Tom Hall, was joined by Annika, Martin and Hugo to talk about the record and how this most unlikely of bands came into being.
Can I just start with Annika? You've done records in the past with Beak and Jeff Barrow and your own solo stuff. How did this new band project come around? Because it's quite an international project, I guess. You've got a Swede here and you've got some Mexicans in the band, and yourself, you're based in Berlin. Tell me how you all met and how it all got off the ground.
Well, Martin's also lived in Mexico for 20 years, so he's officially a bit Mexican. So they were all in one place. I wasn't picking people along the way. You know, we found each other in Mexico City. I suppose after the record with Jeff and with Beak, I moved back to Berlin, and that was that. And I kind of moved forward, and the boys were still, I was still in touch with Beak and with Jeff, but I kind of wanted to explore a bit and find my own way, and they encouraged that. And after a few failed attempts in Berlin, and not so much failed, but I never really successfully found people that I was comfortable recording with again or working with since, you know, after Beak and Jeff and everyone. And then by a strange coincidence of... I was playing a show there and I needed a band, and a friend of mine helped recommend some musicians he knew, and I ended up with, you know, the best the city has to offer. So that was good.
Martin, I mean, were you aware of Annika's work before she came to Mexico?
Yeah, of course.
How did that sort of sit in your musical mindset?
No, of course, yeah. Especially through... another guy's not in the band anymore. He was a big fan of Annika, so we had, of course, heard the records she did before. But I didn't know Annika, and I was actually not supposed to be in the band. But because there was another guy playing the drums, and but he was away, so I was like sort of slipped into the band, which is fine. I mean, I think it's cool with a band. It's more like an accident, you know, and here we are.
And maybe Martin and Hugo, you can sort of tell me and Annika as well, what was the draw of Mexico there? I mean, you were just playing a show there, I understand. What is it about Mexico's music scene that has kind of maybe helped complement this music?
There's like a lot of things happening in Mexico right now, you know? But it's like, I think it's like a global thing, you know? Martin and I were like producers. We are like in touch with a lot of musical scene that's happening right now.
Yeah, I mean, both Hugo and I, we've been producing stuff for a long time. I mean, I've probably done like 20 albums or something, mostly with bands from Mexico. And of course, we know a lot of people, and we've always been into music and stuff.
You've produced Crocodiles as well, I understand. They've made some great pop records. Were there any sort of unique techniques or any unusual elements of when you were making the Exploded View record? What kind of confines were you giving yourself to create this record?
The thing was that we were rehearsing, and then we, as both Hugo and I, we have studios and we have a lot of equipment. And so we decided to, well, let's try it and just throw everything together in like a big soup. And I have this Tascam 388, which is a 8-track recorder, and that was sort of like cool to set up like a live setting in the rehearsal space and the studio and just record everything we were doing. Very limited to 8 tracks. Of course, the
part of the sound is very much like the limitations. It's like almost like a dogma record in that sense, I'd say.
And Annika, you're quite politically minded and you study politics and you worked as a journalist before sort of going into music more full time. Do you try and infuse your music with any kind of political message, or is it more about trying to infuse it with a sense of purpose that other people listening can then take their own political identity from it? Is it about injecting it with a message rather than an agenda?
No, not really. I think it's a bit more self-indulgent than that. It's actually just what's on my mind on that day, you know, and the thing is, I read the newspapers. I'm engaged with politics. So, of course, I have fears or anxieties about the world today, as most people do. And so, sometimes the songs might be about relationship troubles or my struggle with what to do with myself in this world, or about whether what's going on in, I don't know, in the stock market or in the just generally the political climate right now. So it's more just things that are on my mind, and there definitely isn't such a conscious process behind what, you know, the topic selection and that kind of thing. And if anything, it's usually completely unconscious, which is why it was suddenly right to work with these guys, because that's exactly what I try and hit, is when I lose, almost completely lose this self-awareness, and I can freely write without worrying about what I'm writing, because I know I'm not going to be judged, or the music is right and it calms me enough to be able to just write freely. So yeah, it's a very special environment to find, and it's very rare, and a lot of people thought I was crazy to search for this for so long. It took me 6 years, you know, and then suddenly in the most unexpected place you find it. But I think it's definitely personally I'm happy that was one of the main reasons I wanted to make sure this record was released, because, you know, I think it was a lot of anxieties and fears that have been going around my head for the last 6 or more years, and I think it is often not spoken about, and a lot of the topics are very personal and they're very vulnerable in the way they're presented. So, you know, surely that's worth sharing with other people.
Yeah, it's a strange one when people sort of label either an artist or a musician as, in speech marks, political, because it's like politics isn't just one thing, and pretty much everything that everyone does can be politicized in some way. It's like coming to work every day is almost a political gesture, because you're falling into a model and a system, and you're either okay with it and you're not. So it's something that's very hard to kind of like paint in very simple brushstrokes. But what on this record, Annika, what kind of themes were you maybe trying to bring to the fore and maybe to address a little bit?
Yeah, well, again, I tried to throw out these words, try to, because there was no trying to do anything involved, which is the strange thing. You know, we actually weren't intending to record anything or release anything. When we were doing it, it was just in between rehearsals for the show, and it just was sort of weird. We couldn't quite understand what we were making, so we just carried on, you know. And therefore, if you're not actually making something for a market, then you're actually not trying to make anyone happy apart from outside of yourself, you know. And it was more of a way to unclog my brain or unpick these knots that had slowly over the last 6 years, you know, become extreme, the amount of issues that I'd collected, you know. And I had to, it was more of a psychological cleansing, you know.
Yeah,
it's like going to a shrink. But in terms of the topics, I mean, there are some obvious topics in some of the songs, like No More Parties in the Attic was, well, yeah, I guess it's a reference to the Fitzgerald book, Great Gatsby, as well as the present day, and how people are almost doing a similar thing, you know, still having the parties and living in the past, living with nostalgia because nostalgia is safe, and not really dealing with the present, and basically putting on the blinkers to actually what was happening in the world. And it's all very well to live in the nostalgia and live in the past in these little parties in the attic, but soon this house is going to be whittled away, and then you'll be exposed as the walls fall down, and you'll look around and you'll see the apocalypse around you, you know. So you can't just keep ignoring it. It's like, so that's what that was. And there's, you know, obviously things like, I mean, there's a few lines in there that are what they are. But like I say, it was all just unconscious stuff.
Yeah. And Martin, as a producer, I mean, we've got like some very complex and maybe quite heavy themes there. I mean, are you the one in the room that's saying, can we make it sound catchy and fun? Or does that conversation never happen?
No, absolutely not. I think the important thing here is that, I mean, yeah, of course, Ugo and I, we are producing it together, and we sort of set up the scene of crime, or whatever you want to call it. But actually, everyone did their part. Like, no one said anything to anyone. And basically what we were doing was like, okay, let's start doing something, playing some instrument, and we were going around. Basically, I'm playing drums on the record, but I'm a guitarist, and we would also switch instruments and stuff. So we would start jamming or whatever you want to call it, and then if there was something interesting happening, she would be somewhere else in the house, probably listening a little bit and writing lyrics, and just come in and sing on top of that. When we finally, Uga and I, we started to edit the record, I had the idea it was complete rubbish, you know, like this is going to be the most boring recordings ever made.
Right.
And I'm quite surprised how song-based it is.
Yeah.
Because it sounds more like, okay, of course we cut it down, we cut out a lot of stuff, but I thought it would be like really more like jams, and it's really not.
And what are the hopes for this record? I mean, I'm getting the impression that you're not going to try and make some grand plan for 10 albums or anything like that. Are you just going to play it naturally, and are you going to try and follow up the record? I mean, we're very early on in that record's cycle, I guess. But yeah. It's interesting to see whether you have plans to kind of make this work, and how you make it work when you're also spread across the world as well.
We go with the flow, really. You know, we already done some recording, and maybe this time it's actually rubbish. You know, we don't know. But I don't think we plan that much. It just happens, and if it's not good enough, we won't put it out. But if it's great, of course, yeah, we continue.
That was Tom Hall speaking to Annika, Martin and Hugo from Exploded View and the band's self-titled album. It's out now. London Fashion Week is currently in full swing, so what better time to have a conversation about style and the limits of sartorial taste?
Judith Clark is a professor of fashion and museology at London College of Fashion, and she's also a co-creator of an upcoming exhibition at London's Barbican, The Vulgar, Fashion Redefined, along with the psychoanalyst Adam Phillips. The show, beginning next month, questions notions of vulgarity in fashion while also revelling in it and reevaluating the perception of design's excess. And Judith joins us now. Thank you very much
for coming in to join us
at the studio. Now, this is a great idea for a show. I guess there is something of the idea of nothing good ever came out of good taste, right?
Nothing good came out of good taste, of course. Certainly no pleasure ever came out of good taste. And so the exhibition starts with the idea of a word that everybody feels as though they're an expert, you know, around. You know, we all seem to, you know it when we see it. Well, what is this word and how can we celebrate it?
Is there an idea of the popular in vulgarity as much as there is the idea of something that leaves a bit of a funny taste in the mouth? Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. And I think the word evolves, and I won't go through a sort of, you know, history of the word for the purposes of this afternoon, but absolutely it goes from common in a non-pejorative sense to something where people are not quite sure how many people should, you know, participate in these pleasures or knowledge itself, of course.
Yeah.
And tell me, Judith, about, I guess, as a curator or someone who works on an exhibition or a show like this, you're talking about the idea of tastes and people's boundaries, and obviously everyone always says, well, these things are subjective, of course, and what's vulgar to you is perfectly acceptable to me. Is it necessarily a challenge then to try and document this because it's so dependent on subjective readings of what, you know, people who visit and whatever they think about the boundaries of taste?
I mean, I think that's always in play with museum shows. So there are lots of sort of jokes within it because, of course, the museum is always sort of standing in as a sort of arbiter of taste. But it's always true that people come with their own ideas about, you know, there's a sort of their own reactions to any given object. And I think what we want to do is take a word where people come with a particular certainty and then redefine it many times throughout the show. So you don't come with one overarching definition, but you start to look at different aspects of a word and hopefully come out more confused.
And fashion's a really interesting one in notions of vulgarity, because we see the runway collections, the haute couture collections, which play with notions of vulgarity. I think of Galliano and Alexander McQueen, Vivienne Westwood. Some of these names are going to be in your show. But then you see the stuff that people are wearing, that might even have the same label in the bag. And you see some of the, a lot of the vulgarity or the experimentalism ironed out, literally and metaphorically. Do you kind of want to see a bit more? You're reveling in the vulgarity and trying to, wishing we could see a bit more of it on the high street, perhaps.
I mean, it depends whether you're talking about vulgarity or pleasure, sexuality, all the things that are often associated with the
some
word.
Some of that playfulness and some of that gothicism, some of that playfulness, I suppose. Yeah.
I mean, I think it's also a sort of generational thing in that what are you rebelling against? And if taste is going to evolve, of course, you have to sort of design against what is accepted at any given moment. So in a way, fashion looking forward is always in some way unacceptable. I mean, the garments in the exhibition have all been sort of sanctioned. So some would be defined, you know, a Madame Grey 1930s, you know, Grecian goddess dress. No one would go, oh, vulgar. But when placed adjacent to a definition that talks about the copy and put it within the idea of sort of neoclassicism, then suddenly, oh, it's a copy.
Right.
So a copy of what? And in a way, fashion is always a great absorber of ideas, and therefore it sort of regurgitates, you know, ideas all the time.
Judith, do you think there's a time that where that challenge was the most compelling? I know you have a deep understanding of the kind of history of fashion and fashion exhibitions and so on. Was there a time, you know, is it in the 60s or was it in the 70s or is it in the 80s or is it as interesting now as it was then? Was there a period where the battle, if you like, about what was vulgar or how far the boundaries, the envelope could be pushed, was at its most compelling in your view?
I'm not sure. I think, you know, on the one hand, it's always, you know, against its immediate predecessor. But I think around the 60s, it sort of speeds up. And I think you can see it on the street. So it's not this sort of slow evolution where someone dares to shorten a hem, but something is actually designed for impact. And I think that's where things change quite dramatically.
And what about what that tells us about the creative process then? If somebody is designing to shock, does it change, or should it change how we, the viewer or the consumer of these materials or of these garments, how we look at it? Does it matter if the intention is to shock, or is the, should we try and get beyond that to the purity of the expression?
I don't know, but I think that a lot of the debate that has come about in the last, let's say, 20 years or 25 years has been about whether fashion is different when re-described, which is why there's been a debate with whether it's in fact art or et cetera, which I think is a bit of a red herring. But it is an attempt to do that, to ascribe an intention to something that might sit outside our idea of taste, but say, actually, I did that on purpose. So is it still vulgar? You know, is it an accident? You know, where is the accident and where is the intention?
There's an idea of how the public read fashion, you know, almost inversely, snobbishly kind of going, it's all right for these people. And you know, there's been that documentary that you might have watched last week on the BBC, which I thought had an inversely snobbish idea of looking at Vogue magazine, for example. And I wonder whether you encompass those, you include those attitudes in the show.
I think there's always a bit of that in terms of who's making the rules. So, for example, we have a document which is a sumptuary, an Elizabethan sumptuary law, which literally outlaws some garments. So you have to stick to your own order. And I think it in a way answers in part your question about class versus money versus taste versus all of these categories, where anyone who perceives a sort of slippage starts to be a bit nervous. And we have, for example, etiquette books within the exhibition, which are also now very humorous because the idea of sticking to one type is just irrelevant at the moment. But I think the film that you referred to, which I will see tonight, which I look forward to hugely, is important because I think the Met has somehow come to represent a different attitude to fashion exhibition making, and one that has fascinated me for ages, from, you know, when Diana Vreeland was at the helm, so to speak, to the wonderful exhibitions that Andrew Bolton puts on, but that has outside or around it this other world. And so the relationship between the exhibition and the opening.
Judith, can I ask you something else about another metric if we're looking at the redefining or the defining of vulgarity? You are from Australia originally, is that right? And you spent a lot of time when you were growing up in Italy, and you've worked obviously in London, and you live here presumably as well. does that play a factor? Depending on where you are in the world, does either what people believe to be vulgar... Well, I guess, in short, what I'm asking you is, where do we find the most vulgar people, certainly out of those three nations?
Thanks. Thanks for that question.
That's an easy one. Is that another factor? Is it very different depending where you go?
Yes, but I think it plays into the hands of that we already know what the vulgar is. And so one might say, well, of course, Australia.
we might say that if we were not
Exactly. If I were not Australian. but I can say it because I am Australian. And I think, for example, my mother was very, very, very preoccupied, right, not being vulgar. You know, she really was guarding the boundary really quite...
the dustpan
quite
brush.
Anxiously. And I think it was perhaps to do with her nationality. I don't know. I certainly think often of Italian fashion being so conservative when I was growing up, but now being associated with such a greater sort of, you know, celebration both of sexuality, of a kind of, I don't know, of celebration of a sort of commercial world. There's no apology within Italian fashion. And the beginnings of a kind of commentary on that with people like Prada, where, you know, it's really against the this goes with this goes with this. The kind of rules and regulations of Italian fashion are used very humorously, I think, at the moment.
So do you think we're almost then in a post categorizing of these kind of things?
Yes.
And actually it won't even be a discussion, and it will be down to people to sort of look back and look at the redefinitions, and in the contemporary realm people won't be preoccupied by this anymore.
It'll
just be about
so.
The aesthetic statements or
the
purity
absolutely.
Of work.
And if you said, what are the sort of percentages of one, you know, nationality's, you know, design over another within the exhibition, I couldn't tell you.
There's not that much sort of vulgar Scandinavian design. Do you know what I mean? And therefore, it's kind of not very interesting. That's my personal take on it. No, but do you know what I mean? You need a bit of vulgarity. You need a bit of grit to make the oyster, right? That's what you need.
Yeah, it's anyway, not a Scandinavian who? Show.
No,
that's
I know.
For sure.
I know.
It's sort of. But I think that it is. There is a lot of English design, I think, because I think a lot of English designers certainly, for the past sort of 20 years, play so much with the sort of irony and, you know, quotation and, you know, just playfulness within fashion that you can't get around that.
No, exactly. There's a lot of sense of humour in that. Long met rain as
yes,
well.
Exactly.
I can't wait for this show. Judith, thank you so much for coming in to talk to us. It's happening in a month's time after you've had your fashion fix at Fashion Week. The show is going to be called The Vulgar, Fashion Redefined, and it's at the Barbican. Judith Clark, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Tom, there we have it. Edition 376 of the Monocle Weekly.
What a gem.
I really enjoyed that show.
Great programme.
I think we got on with Harry Shearer. I think he enjoyed his time here.
It was fun. And what was interesting was I am an unashamed fan of, you know, so much of his output from Spinal Tap to The Simpsons and so forth. And it was tempting to ask him to share some of his famous voices with us. But I know that's not really the done thing. But every now and again, you could just hear the lilt, the timbre, a little tenor of somebody else, something other, and it would creep in. It's quite extraordinary talking to him in person.
Yeah, he's good, isn't he? And I've seen him interviewed on so many things. His radio show is great, and it's nice to share a bit of podcast love.
And he had a fine hat.
Judith was great talking about the fashion show. I can't wait to see that at the Barbican and Exploded View. Tom
Are you
Hall,
a vulgar individual?
I'm definitely vulgar.
Yeah, okay, there we go. Wrap that up.
Do you think you are?
Oh, no, I'd
I think say... Too, I think there's quite a lot of good taste, isn't there?
Yeah.
You can have too much of it.
Well...
Shall we fold up our scripts and say goodbye? Today's show was produced by Tom Hall and researched by Bill Luti and Beatrice Carmi and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And our studio manager was Claire Urban. And the Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bowne.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thanks for tuning in.